Hello, everybody. This is George Ann Hughes, and this is The Bite Show. And we're very blessed to have David Seeloff with us. He is the Director of Associates for Scriptural Knowledge. And you can go to the website, Ask Elm, that's ASKELM.com. You can also email David Seeloff at this address, david@askelm.com. And we're going to be talking about idolatry and God's punishment, part four. And part four deals with judgment of the gods, God's judgment on them. And there on David's special page at The Bite Show, where we archive his files, you have a link to the article that this audio series is based on. So you can go there and read and look around. A lot of interesting information. Anyway, okay, hi, David.
Hi, Georgianne.
How are you doing?
I'm doing fine. We're moving along. We'll probably put this article to bed, this series of four.
Yeah.
And this time, in the article, Idolatry and God's Punishment, we are at the point of a subhead called Judgments Against the Gods.
Okay. And I got it turned around. Sorry.
No, that's fine. And the, God declares judgment against humans, but he also declares judgment against the gods, the pagan
right.
gods. And unless you're not carefully reading the texts, you won't recognize the distinction that God is declaring a punishment against the gods on the one hand by one term, and punishment against, talking about the idols, the physical constructions that represent the gods
yeah.
in the same passage. And people confuse the two and say, well, the gods are the idols, and the idols are the physical constructions, which are the same as the gods. That's actually not the case. The ancients never worshipped the physical idols. They always worshipped the god that the idol merely represented. This needs to be clearly understood. They never thought that the god was that piece of wood or metal, any more than a Catholic person believes that Mary is the wooden statue or the clay statue or the plastic statue right there. They didn't worship the object. They worshiped the being behind the object. Likewise, veneration, or all too often worship of Mary,
yeah.
is, in effect it's worship many times, even though they call it veneration,
yeah.
is directed toward a spirit being that appears and has appeared through history in many spirit beings probably as Mary. Likewise, the pagan gods in their various forms, each civilization had apparently the god would represent himself in different forms and different ways to different nations.
Could we think of this also, David, as the principalities and powers over nations, that came to be in dark places?
Yes, yeah. And in general, those would be spirits, angelic beings, and demonic beings today.
Right.
I don't think any of the sons of God are actively working in that vein at present. I think most of them have been exiled or killed per Psalm 82. And we'll get into some of this here in the judgments against the gods.
Okay.
And in ancient times, it was common for victorious nations to carry away the gods and the idols of the conquered nation and install them in their own temples. This demonstrated, of course, the superiority of the victorious nation. And it also showed the dispossession, abandonment, and exile of the Elohim represented by those idols from the conquered nation. In other words, literally, our gods are better than your gods because they helped us conquer you. In fact, God's judgment against certain of the gods of Egypt started during the Exodus, long before the time of David and long before Psalm 82. In Exodus chapter 12 and verse 12, it says, quote, "For I will pass through," this is at the night of the Passover, "I will pass through the land of Egypt this night, and I will smite all the firstborn of the land of Egypt, both man and beast, and against the gods of Egypt I will execute judgment. I am Yahweh," end quote. Now, it's interesting here. God not only kills, you know, says he will kill the firstborn of Egypt, but he also said that he will execute judgment against the gods of Egypt. And, of course, the Passover was the final judgment against Egypt, and each of the plagues that afflicted Egypt represented the superiority of Yahweh over the Egyptian gods. This is in the background of every event, whether it's the flies, the frogs, or the darkness. Each of those events leading up to the Passover was a demonstration of the impotence of the pagan gods. That's always has to be kept in mind, and you can literally research the Egyptian gods and see how they were put down and made fun of by Yahweh himself, by essentially showing that the gods of Egypt were as nothing compared to Yahweh. And those gods of Egypt at that time, at the time of the Exodus, were likely some of the sons of God, which was a different judgment than the Psalm 82 judgment in the time of David. Mm. Now, in this passage, declared the judgment that God declared in Exodus 12:12 was declared and promised, and this, and it says in Numbers chapter 33, verse 4, that it was carried out and fulfilled. Quote, "For the Egyptians buried all their firstborn, which Yahweh had smitten among them. Upon their gods also Yahweh executed judgment," judgments, end quote. Now, in both of these verses, Exodus 12:12 and Numbers 33, verse 4, in both of these verses, there was a twofold fulfillment. First, there was a judgment against the land of Egypt, against the humans and the animals, because even the firstborn of the animals were killed. And second, there was a fulfillment against the Elohim of Egypt, and that's the word that's used when it says gods in Numbers 33:4 and Exodus 12:12. So, you know, let me pose a question. If the gods of the pagans, such as the gods of Egypt in these verses, were not real or had no actual power, why would God bother to, quote, execute judgment, end quote, over them? Why not just say, you know, the gods of Egypt are not real?
Yeah, good point.
Yahweh executed judgment over the firstborn of Egypt, and they died.
Yeah.
Are we to suppose that the, quote, gods of Egypt, end quote, were any less punished as he prophesied? No, that punishment was fulfilled. Indeed, during the time of Nebuchadnezzar, God again promised to punish the gods of Egypt. And this is found in Jeremiah chapter 46, verse 25 and 26. Now, I'll let you look it up for yourselves. God also declared that he would punish the gods of Babylon, and particularly the god Bel by name. And this is Jeremiah 51, verses 44 to 47. "And God's judgments will be done and accomplished." So there was a god, an Elohim, by the name of Bel, who sometime after the judgment pronounced in Jeremiah, received judgment. He may not have received it even today, but I'm betting that he did. Because when we get glimpses of this stuff, they don't always, you know, we don't always see the fulfillment because it doesn't deal with Israel or with us. And we don't need to know those details. sometimes we get glimpses, but we don't get everything that we might want to know. But why would God punish the gods of Egypt in the future of Jeremiah, and then again talk about judging the gods of Babylon if these gods were not real? In the time of Isaiah, God declared punishment against, quote, the host of the high ones, end quote. And note that, quote, the foundations of the earth are mentioned also, just as in Psalm 82:7. And we're going to read this rather long verse in Isaiah. The prophesied judgment regarding the host of the high ones and the foundations of the earth shall take place at a time future to us today. And they will be very serious times, and they will be very dangerous times. Now I'm going to quote portions of Isaiah 24, verses 18 to 22, starting with verse 18. Quote, and it shall come to pass, and then moving on, and the foundations of the earth do shake. Moving on again. The earth is utterly broken down. The earth is clean dissolved. The earth is moved exceedingly. The earth shall reel to and fro like a drunkard, and shall be removed like a cottage. And the transgression thereof shall be heavy upon it, and it shall fall and not rise again. And it shall come to pass in that day that Yahweh shall punish the host of the high ones on high, and the kings of the earth upon the earth. And they shall be gathered together, meaning both the host of the high ones and the kings, as prisoners are gathered in the pit, and shall be shut up in the prison, and after many days they shall be visited. End quote. The phrase the high ones is another title for gods, for Elohim, other than Yahweh. And these are the same gods who attend the divine assemblies in heaven. It may include angels in this case. In this case, the gathering and imprisonment will be done by God, probably at the second coming, when the Son of Man sends forth his angels into the world, as we know from Matthew 13, verses 41 to 42, and Matthew 16:27. There are many, many who will be put into the pit as prisoners. So many, in fact, that they are termed a host, which is a term used for an army. Yahweh is, quote, the Most High. He is the Most High El of the High Ones. And there's a fascinating study. You should study the term of Yahweh, description of Yahweh as being the Most High, and the implications that can be gained from that are very, very interesting. He's the Most High in compared to other high ones. And I'm not going to go into all the verses, it's quite a long list, but it's a very interesting study and in concordance, and it's pretty clear, even in the King James, you can do a good concordance study on the High Ones, and the Most High. So the judgment against the High Ones, along with the judgment of the kings of the earth, is related to the shakings of the foundations of the earth. And as we noted in Job 38, verse 4 and 6, and in Psalm 82, verse 5, that we cited in prior presentations, the gods shall perish from both the earth and from the heavens. And both mortals and immortals are punished for misdeeds and misuse of power as Yahweh, with Yahweh as the judge. And this is brought out in, as we mentioned, Mullen's book, The Divine Council. We mentioned that last time, citing that book in pages 232 and 233. It's well understood in ancient times that both mortals and immortals are punished for misdeeds and misuse of power. So that in Jeremiah chapter 10, it's verses 10 and 11, it says, quote, but Yahweh is the true God. He is the living God and an everlasting king. At his wrath, the earth shall tremble, and the nations shall not be able to abide his indignation. Thus shall you say unto them, quote, the gods that have not made the heavens and the earth, even they shall perish from the earth and from under the heavens, end quote, end quote. Now, this is interesting. It talks about the true God who was the creator, and then there are other gods who had not made heaven and earth, the angelics, and that they shall perish from the earth and from the heavens. They will be gathered, apparently, and thrown in the pit, along with, I would say, probably along with Satan, although there might be a different pit. Remember in Revelation it talks about the pit being opened somewhere. It's near the Euphrates. The Euphrates is opened up, and there's some type of pit where these creatures come out of. Well, this apparently is after that fact, or it may have happened during the time of Jeremiah. They were thrown into the pit to be released later. I'm not clear at this point which is the case. Okay,
yeah.
I think it's talking about some type of end time thing, but it could be relating to the time of Jeremiah. Toward the end of the kingdom of Judah, God had Jeremiah, the prophet, prophesy that the nation of Judah was to be exiled for the very reason of worshiping pagan gods. Now, you can acknowledge that other gods existed, you just can't worship them.
Yeah.
Judah was worshiping so many pagan gods that Jeremiah complained that they had one god for every town in Judah.
Oh my goodness.
And this is in Jeremiah 11, verses 12 to 13. Quote, then shall the cities of Judah and inhabitants of Jerusalem go and cry unto the gods unto whom they offered incense. But they, the gods, shall not save them in the time of their trouble. For according to the number of your cities were your gods, O Judah, and according to the number of the streets of Jerusalem have you set up altars to that shameful thing, even altars to burn incense unto Baal, end quote. The people of Judah made the foolish mistake of trusting the gods of Egypt and the gods Baal, and thinking that Egypt and their gods would protect Judah. Apparently they did incense in the city to Baal, but the kings and the leaders were looking to the gods of Egypt and to the... Now, it's true that when they say the gods of Egypt, it may have been referring to the pharaohs who were considered to be gods. But I think it means both and, in this case, both the human pharaohs as well as the pagan gods. So that they thought that Egypt and her gods would protect Judah. In other words, they abandoned Yahweh, or that they could flee to safety in Egypt, believing that they would be out of reach of the Babylonian armies of Nebuchadnezzar. And Jeremiah says this in Jeremiah 46, verse 25 to 26. Quote, Yahweh of hosts, the God of Israel, says, behold, I will punish the multitude of No, that's N-O, I don't know who he is, and Pharaoh and Egypt with their gods, and their kings, even Pharaoh, and all them that trust in him. And I will deliver them, meaning including their gods, into the hands of those that seek their lives, and into the hands of Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, and into the hand of his servants. And afterward it shall be inhabited as in the days of old, says Yahweh, end quote. In a time future to us today, we are informed that the king of the south shall attack the king of the north from Egypt, which the king of the south is generally understood, and I believe truthfully, to be Egypt, probably including some portion of perhaps even Saudi Arabia, and shall carry the king of the south shall attack the king of the north from Egypt and shall take away the gods of the king of the north back to Egypt. So there will be a return to paganism in the area of Turkey and Iraq. And this is to be found in Daniel 11, verse 8, according to the Revised Standard Version. Quote, "He shall also carry off to Egypt their gods, their Elohim, with their molten images and with their precious vessels of gold and silver. And for some years he shall refrain from attacking the king of the north." End quote. Now that hasn't happened yet, although I have even some people, some friends of mine who actually believe that that's in process of happening. That has not happened. I mean, this would be a public thing, and the king of the south has not yet attacked the king of the north, nor is Egypt about to. So there's a lot of years to come before Egypt becomes wealthy and before the gods again become prevalent in the area north of Israel, and that they return to some type of paganism. And note also in this passage that there is a distinction between the gods and the molten images. It says, "He shall carry off to Egypt their Elohim with their molten images and with their precious vessels of silver and gold." So they are distinct from each other as they are each carried off. The text is not talking about trinkets, boundary markers, or museum artifacts. In reality, at present, there are very few people in Syria, Turkey, or Iraq, which are the lands ruled in the future by the King of the North. There might be other areas north of that also. But very few people in those areas worship false gods or have idols, at least at the present time. The populations are mostly Muslim, and the Muslim practice forbids the making of images of gods or animals or even of humans. You won't find it in Muslim. Wherever Islam is prevalent as a culture, a government, or a society, you will not find images of gods, animals, or humans. It is in none of their artwork. Occasionally you will see animals, but even that is rare. If they exist, such images have not come to light in the media or in religious studies, as far as anyone knows. The peoples of the area of the King of the North are at present much less idolatrous than Orthodox Christianity in those areas. Apparently, according to Daniel 11:8, at some time in the future, there will be a return to worship of pagan gods with molten images in the lands of the King of the North. These gods and images will be desired and seized by the King of the South. Now, if it was talking about Christian icons and images, why would those be desired by the King of the South, who is probably a Muslim also? It's my understanding, from just this passage alone in Daniel 11:8, which is still future to us, that this means that real Elohim, real gods, will be once again involved in the lands of the King of the North at this time. They may be angelic beings, or they may be sons of God who have not yet died. The text doesn't delineate or make that clear, because angels are Elohim also. In any case, supernatural beings and their corresponding images will be captured and carried south to Egypt. These gods are differentiated from their idols. Jeremiah also prophesies against the gods, against Moab, and against Edom. In Jeremiah 48, verse 7, once again in the Revised Standard Version, it says, quote, "And Chemosh shall go forth into exile with his priests and his princes." In Jeremiah 49, verse 3, again the Revised Standard Version, it says, quote, "For Milcom, who is Molech, in the Hebrew, shall go into exile with his priests and his princes." Now, it's interesting that if these gods were not real beings, if they were imaginary, if they were just the idols, then why does God and his prophets, why do God and his prophets proclaim judgment against them? The answer is that these gods not only had names, but they were real entities. They were real beings. These Elohim did exist, and they were taken captive and punished, as the biblical text says in Jeremiah 48 and 49. The words exile above can also mean captivity, depending on the context. Captivity seems to be the lot of some Elohim, at least some. Perhaps captivity applies to the angelic spirits that 1 Peter 3:19 talks about in Jude 6. Rather than the sons of God who were given a sentence of death, there being a distinction between the angelic spirits and the sons of God. The sons of God were given a sentence of death in Psalm 82, but maybe some got off of earth. I don't know. And they'll be coming back. In the future, in Daniel chapter 7, verses 9 to 10, it says there will be another. There will be another judgment scene that will take place. Quote, I beheld till the thrones were cast down, and the Ancient of Days did sit, the thrones of the nations, and the Ancient of Days did sit, whose garment was white as snow, and the hair of his head was like the pure wool. His throne was like the fiery flame, and his wheels as burning fire. A fiery stream issued and came forth before him. Thousand thousands ministered unto him, and 10,000 times 10,000 stood before him. The judgment was set, and the books were opened. The judgment means the judgment of the court scene was set, meaning it was made ready, and the books were opened. Like we've mentioned in Psalm 82, that was a court and a judgment scene. Once again, there will be a future judgment in Daniel 7, chapter 7, verses 9 and 10. Yahweh, the chief El, is here called the Ancient of Days, in the vision of a time future to Daniel, gives the sovereignty then to the Son of Man. He does that in verse 13 of Daniel 7. The Ancient of Days gives sovereignty of the earth to the Son of Man. This is the sovereignty that El took back to himself in Psalm 82, and then he gives it to the Elohim in Psalm 82:8. He gives it to Jesus, the only begotten Son of God, and this according to John 1:18, John 3:16-18, and 1 John 4:9. The only begotten Son of God, who was and is righteous, and who is also the Son of Man. In Matthew 28:18 it says, And Jesus came and spoke unto them, saying, All power is given unto me in heaven and in earth. And then Jesus, end quote. And Jesus said unto the high priest during his judgment in Matthew 26:64, quote, Hereafter you shall see the Son of Man sitting on the right hand of power, coming in the clouds of heaven, end quote. And this is a direct reference. And he says this to the high priest, identifying himself with the Son of Man in Daniel 7, verse 13. Now, as in the days of Noah, just before Christ returns to this earth, conditions will be similar in some ways to those that existed before the flood. Now notice the interesting point that Jesus made during his discourse with his disciples in Matthew 24, verses 35 to 39. Quote, Heaven and earth shall pass away, but my words shall not pass away. But of that day and hour knows no man, no, not the angels of heaven, but the Father only. But as the days of Noah were, so shall also the coming of the Son of Man be. For as in the days that were before the flood, they were eating and drinking, marrying and giving in marriage, until the day that Noah entered into the ark, and knew not until the flood came and took them away, so shall also the coming of the Son of Man be. End quote. To be sure, Christ's intent was to emphasize that ordinary life will continue right up to his second coming, just as ordinary life, day-to-day life, continued right up to the flood of Noah. However, notice that Jesus specifies, quote, marrying and giving in marriage, end quote, to indicate continuity of life before the disasters of the last plagues, in Revelation, which he's referring to those last plagues in Revelation chapter 15 and following. Those plagues from God strike just prior to the coming of the Son of Man. But note this, the only marriage events mentioned before the flood in Genesis are those of Genesis chapter 6, were those of the sons of God taking wives of the daughters of men. I almost hesitate to ask the question because I don't myself like the answer. It seems too bizarre in this modern age. Does this Christ's mention of marriage in Matthew 24, 37 to 39 mean that events similar to those which occurred in Genesis chapter 6, verses 1 to 4, with the sons of God marrying human women and producing hyper-evil offspring, will such events occur again just before Christ's second coming? I think this is precisely what Jesus is warning us about in this passage. Now, the strange and bizarre events that occur with the beings in the spiritual realm, and they're going to be really desperate because their time will be short. Not just the nations will be desperate when Christ returns and fight against him, but all the spirit beings in the universe, except what appears to be actually perhaps even a minority in the universe, will oppose Christ's second coming. With all this support, the evil beings, the evil humans, and even the Antichrist, it will give them a misconception that they can win.
Yeah.
Because they're not crazy. They're brilliant. Satan is brilliant.
Yeah.
And they must think that with all this support, we can beat this thing. There will be a lot of strange and bizarre events that will occur, like I said, with these beings in the spiritual realm, whether they be sons of God, angels, evil spirits, things out of the pit, which will test our fears and level of fright. However, we should fear only one thing and nothing else, and that's God. We should fear God. And remembering who we are, as we fear God, we should remember who we are as God's children, seated with Christ on his throne at this present time. This is according to Ephesians 1, verse 3. Fear of the Lord is the basic starting point for everything connected with God. The sons of God and all too many angels seem to have been foolish and have despised wisdom and instruction, according, you know, as it says in Proverbs 1, verse 7. Perhaps because of their proximity and their familiarity with God himself, many of those in the divine assembly apparently abandoned God and committed sin, just like the human family has done, beginning with Adam. And God's own nation, Israel, abandoned God and committed sin. Perhaps they, these spirit beings, like some in reprobate Israel, no longer fear God, as Paul talks about in Romans chapter 3, verse 18. We should fear God because of the manifold benefits that accrue from this, from doing so. Fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge. This is in Proverbs 1, verse 7. Fear of the Lord is also the beginning of wisdom. This is in Psalm 111, verse 10, and Proverbs 9:10. Fear of the Lord itself gives instruction in wisdom. This is said in Proverbs 15, verse 33. Fear of the Lord is actually wisdom itself. To do that act is wise. This is in Job 28, verse 28. Fear of the Lord is a treasure to have. It says in Isaiah 33, verse 6. Fear of the Lord perfects holiness. Paul says in 2 Corinthians 7 and verse 1. Fear of the Lord contributes to proper submission of one to another. And this is in Ephesians chapter 5, verse 21. And finally, fear of the Lord is the gospel that the angel will proclaim just before God's judgment. This is stated in chapter 14, verse 7. Now, it's been said with some truth that the word fear in these verses means respect, honor, homage to God, the Father. While this is all true, there is also the aspect of absolute and sheer terror of Yahweh in every one of those verses listed above. Proper fear and proper terror, as well as respect, honor, and homage. Not just because you fear Him, but because you also love Him and He loved us first, as confirmed through His gift of His Son to not only take away our sins, but to impart Christ's righteousness to us. Now, this aspect of fear and terror, fear as terror, is confirmed by Nahum, the book of Nahum, chapter 1, verse 2, and also by the Apostle Paul in Hebrews chapter 10, verse 31, verses 30 and 31. God demands proper respect and fear that is due Him. In 1 John chapter 4, verses 15 to 18, it says, quote, "Whosoever shall confess that Jesus is the Son of God, God dwells in him and he in God. And we have known and believed that the love that God has to us, God is love, and he that dwells in love dwells in God, and God in him. Herein is our love made perfect, that we may have boldness in the day of judgment," the day of judgment that's coming in the future, "because as he is, so are we in this world. There is no fear in love, but perfect fear." Boy, talk about lousing up a punchline. "There is no fear in love, but perfect love casts out fear.
Fear, yes.
Because fear has torment.
Yes.
And he that fears is not made perfect in love." So, even though we are supposed to fear the Lord and it gives us good benefits, there is a proper fear that is fear out of love. In other words, we fear to offend God at all, and that's a better fear, and that is also fear of the Lord. One defect that seems to be shared by those who received God's judgments in the past was that they overestimated God's patience and mercy and minimized God's righteousness and judgment, whether it's humans or spirit beings. They thought that God winks at sin and that he gives a pass at evil against evils that are committed against the helpless, and that God ignores completely the cries of those who suffer. God will have mercy. God have mercy on those who so falsely believe, because he might not have mercy on them. So in conclusion, I will be writing more on this, particularly the relationship, the direct relationship of Psalm 82 to the passage in the later part of John chapter 10, when Jesus confronts the judges, the rulers of Israel. In the future, I will cover the nature and the destiny of the Nephilim, who are the giants, who are the offspring of the sons of God and the daughters of men in Genesis chapter 6 and verse 4. And this is a terrible, important subject that relates to the nature of evil spirits. It might even relate to the origin of evil spirits. I still have work to do in this area.
Yeah.
And second, Psalm 82 is directly referred to in an extended discussion that Jesus had teaching in the temple with Jews attending the Feast of the Dedication. The time frame of this discussion is important. The fact that it's the Feast of Dedication is also important. And you can look this up in, as I said, Jesus, at this place, Jesus is asked directly if he is the Messiah.
Yeah.
He answers them directly, and they do not like the answer because he makes a connection of his messiahship to Psalm 82, particularly verse 8, in a surprising way that the Jews do not like. The Jews became so angry with Jesus that they tried to seize and attack him. Now you can read the passage for yourself and see if you can understand what Jesus meant by his reference to Psalm 82. And keep in mind that when Jesus cites one portion of a small psalm, such as this one, he is referring to the entire psalm and not just that one portion. And this is found in John chapter 10, verses 22 to 39, and go back and forth between John 10, 22 to 39 and Psalm 82, and see if you can get a preview of what I'll be writing on in the future in this. So that concludes the article, Idolatry and God's Punishment. I apologize for leaving a cliffhanger here, but I can only do so much. So thank you, Georgianne, for the opportunity to present this material.
This was just too short. Gosh. Oh, golly. Well, this is very, very interesting material. For sure, David. And, you know, that the part of the Gospels where you mentioned about, you know, it will be as it was in the days of Noah.
Yeah.
Marrying and giving in marriage. Very, very interesting.
Yeah.
You
and
know,
how that'll play out, we don't know.
Yeah.
Now, I also think that the angelic beings were also involved in some of this hanky-panky because in Jude and Peter, it talks about fornication. Now, the sons of God in Genesis 6 were married to those women. Now, you can still have fornication within marriage, but there's no condemnation of the sons of God for marrying those women. Their condemnation comes in Psalm 82,
yeah,
which is relating to the unjust judgment as the gods of the nations. So it's interesting. Particularly interesting if you maintain the distinctions between angelic beings in Jude and Peter, mm-hmm, and the sons of God in Genesis 6 and Psalm 82 and other places. And it does make sense. And when the sons of God, when the judgments of Psalm 82 were actually accomplished and punishment meted out, I believe the angelics took over, and we see evidence of that with the Prince of Gracia, the Prince of Persia, and who were angelic beings who took over the rulership of the nations. And
they're the principalities and powers in dark places.
Exactly,
yeah.
Exactly. Now, whether the principalities and powers includes the sons of God, and we know that not all the sons of God sinned because Christ was a son of God, the son of the God, the son of God. It's stated several different ways in the New Testament with the definite article.
He's the only begotten one, though.
Right.
Very
and
special.
He never sinned before. He never sinned in his incarnation as in human flesh. Or in the likeness of sin's flesh, but in flesh. And he never sinned after his resurrection and ascension. He was the only sinless creation. There may be one or two angels. Dr. Martin believed that there was. I'm not so sure. But talk about a minor matter. That's
yeah,
about as minor as you can have. Perhaps the angel of the Lord has not sinned either. But that's an angel. That's not a son of God. It's clear that Jesus Christ is distinct as the first creation of God and as the Son of God from actually the beginning. It's just that that was not revealed until the incarnation, that he was the, and as you say, obviously the only begotten Son of God, which itself, that title itself, implies other sons of God.
Well, he was never, though, David, I don't think, running around in a flesh and blood body ever before he was came through the womb of Mary.
Right.
Know, like you know, a human body like you or I have. He didn't exist in that form prior to his birth to Mary.
Probably not, although I am hesitant to state that every occurrence of Yahweh interacting with humans, whether it's with Moses or Abraham or walking in the garden, that those are the angel of the Lord, unless it specifies that it's the angel of the Lord. Now, if it's not the angel of the Lord, who was it? Was it the Father? No, because no man has seen the Father. That's clear from the later clarifying Old New Testament passage.
Yeah.
So who was it? Was it Christ, who also had the name of Yahweh, but who was not an angel, as is clear from Hebrews 1:5? He is not the angel of the Lord. But then who was that being who, when God walked in the garden and wrestled with Jacob and spoke with Abraham? Those are things I haven't worked out yet.
Yeah, they're very interesting things.
They could be the angel of the Lord, but unless it's specified, I am hesitant to apply that there. Now, to me it would make sense that where the angel of the Lord is specified, that's who is being referred to as Yahweh at that time. He has full legal authority and power of attorney to use that term, Yahweh. So does Christ now.
Yes.
And did he have that power of attorney back then? I don't know. I haven't looked into that in detail. And that's certainly something we can disagree about, even among, you know, the other speakers on your shows.
Well, my goodness, scholars everywhere.
Yeah.
David, nobody agrees on every detail of everything. And that's why we encourage people to go be like a Berean and study it for themselves.
Right, yeah. Right. Because, you know, our advantage, even though we are not technical scholars to the extent that we would like to be, many of us, we at least take the text at face value and take it seriously, that it means what it says, unless it's clear that it's a metaphor.
What is the oldest Hebrew text that we have access to?
It could be Job, although Job was probably the best explanation I've understood. Is that Job was given to Moses probably from his father-in-law Jethro. Now, the writings of Genesis, Moses compiled those from older documents. But,
and we no longer have those documents.
Right, right. Yeah. And, yeah, we no longer have those documents, you know, where it talks about the generations of Noah, the generations of Seth. Those were, it's quite clear that those were written documents that existed because they fit exactly the form of tablets that were written in ancient times.
Yeah.
The nature of the top of the tablet and the nature of the bottom of the tablet are exactly what those writings in Genesis are like. And then when you go from, say, turn a page, go from one tablet to another, at the bottom of the first tablet is the last line of the bottom of the first tablet is repeated in the first line of the second tablet. And you find this in writings of books, of very early books. I have a book written by Adam Weishaupt about the apology of the Illuminati. Yes. And sure enough, it has the last line of the left-hand page is repeated on the first line of the right-hand page. And until you realize this, it gets a little confusing. And even some of the scribes miss this, probably during the time of Ezra. And they put both of them in. So you have a repetition of the same line. And you wonder, well, why is that repeated? It's not for emphasis necessarily. It's because that was the bottom line and the top line, and the scribes left them there. It's not a mistake. It just makes it even more complete. And it gives evidence that we're dealing with tablets of very old documents.
Yeah.
Which actually reinforces the reality and the validity of the documents. Now, those original documents would have been older than Moses, and Job was older than Moses, if in fact Jethro gave that to him, his father-in-law.
Yeah.
So that, you know, it's a toss-up whether, when did Moses write Genesis, or compile, when did Moses author Genesis from the documents that he had at hand? He probably did that in the, you know, while he was in the wilderness after the Passover. So, you know, did he do that before he met Jethro or after? Who knows? So it's either Job or the Genesis, which is probably the earliest document of the Bible. That's why some of the unique terms in Job only occur once, and we don't know what they mean, even though we have a translation of those terms from the Greek Old Testament. Some of those Greek translations of these Hebrew terms that are only used once, they don't make a lot of sense, or they don't fit. So we're not sure what they mean. So I have no doubt that someday before the second coming, something will occur that will make those words plain, because there's a lot of science in the book of Job.
Yes.
A lot of science.
Yeah.
And, you know, references to beings that appear to me to be descriptions of dinosaurs and large reptilians. So.
Well, you know, in the book of Genesis, in some of the footnotes in an old Bible that I've got, it says, you know, one footnote will say Yahwist source, and
yeah,
the next footnote will say Deuteronomist source. What does that mean?
I don't think that has much meaning.
Okay.
Obviously, it's quite clear that Yahweh was not the person. The being Yahweh was known to Abraham,
mm-hmm,
but I don't think that Abraham called him by the name of Yahweh, because I don't think that name was given until the time of Moses.
Yeah.
And Moses inserted that into the texts that he compiled Genesis from. Okay, so those were used by Moses to clarify things. And they could have been changed by David or Samuel, who wrote for David. They could have been changed. Some of those things could have been changed by Hezekiah under the tutelage of Isaiah. They could have been changed during the time of Jeremiah or the time of Ezra. All of those had the authority to write and to change scripture of the older documents. They had full authority to do that.
That's kind of scary.
Well, it's fine with me if God gives them the authority to do that. You know, they can do that.
Well, you know, if God gives them that authority, but for men to just arbitrarily change something, or a scribe you know, a member of the Sopharim, if you will,
right,
to just, you know, well, because human beings have prejudices.
Sure.
And later on, some of these scribes, I mean, do we have any evidence that certain things may have been altered or changed?
Yeah, you have definite indications where geographical locations are updated and text is inserted where it says that so-and-so, which is now known as so-and-so, you know, this place, which is now known as this place. That's an obvious insertion.
Yeah.
Why would Moses put that in?
Yeah.
Although he, in any case, he was inserting that into the documents that he had in front of him when he compiled Genesis. Now, the other books of the Torah, you know, the Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy, mm-hmm. those were written entirely by Moses, you know, as the prime author. He didn't use documents for those. It's also quite obvious that the mention in the, at the end of Deuteronomy, talking about the death of Moses, was written by someone else after Moses died. So, and Joshua had that authority to do that. So, you know, it's not a problem at all, really.
Well, you know, like in Genesis 1, Genesis 2, we have what a lot of people tend to think of as two different creation stories. Isn't it possible that it is the same story told by two different people?
Or told in two different ways.
Ways, yes.
For two purposes.
Yes, perfect. Yeah.
You know, and both are right.
Yeah.
Just like the Gospels. There are differences between the Gospels, depending on the perspective.
Right.
There's, we've been doing a series of articles on the Gospel of John. The Gospel of John is radically different, particularly in time, from the Synoptic Gospels. And there's a specific reason for that. The Gospel of John is an idealized chronological system.
Yeah.
So that Christ is the Passover, and he dies at the moment of the Passover lamb being killed. But the Synoptic Gospels have Christ being crucified after the Passover. How do you reconcile those? You reconcile those by different purposes of the authors.
Yeah.
And it's clear once you understand what was being indicated by each author.
Yeah.
So, and there's no contradiction, you might say, at all. Now, you know, there's sometimes when you can be too literal, you know,
yeah.
the sun does not rise in the morning, Scripture says, that the sun does rise. Well, it doesn't, technically, but from the perception of the individual at the time, knowing what they knew, the sun did rise. And we use that phrase today.
Yes, we do.
However, if you cannot hold, say, that God made a mistake because in technicality, if the sun doesn't rise, but the earth goes around, the sun or the revolution of the earth causes the sun to appear to rise. Well, that doesn't mean that Scripture is mistaken. It's just reporting what is a common understanding and experience. There's nothing wrong with that. That doesn't mean that it's unscientific or wrong. So, you know, you can claim to be hyper-literal, even though that's not was never the intent of the author or the common understanding of the audience. Authors write to audiences who understand, and then who have a basic understanding, and then the author is informing the audience of something they didn't know based on their prior knowledge.
Right.
So that they could understand before, comparing the new material with what they already knew, and either correcting a mistake or adding new material. All authors do that. And God is doing that right up to the end. What Abraham knew a lot more than Adam and Eve and a lot more than Noah. And, you know, Moses knew a lot more than Abraham.
Yeah.
Because God revealed more. And, you know, the prophets knew more than Moses. And literally, the law had gone through changes in the time of Jeremiah.
Mm-hmm.
It's quite obvious that the Mosaic law was changed by the authorities with God's permission, and it was that law that they disobeyed.
Yeah.
Now, it was not a big deal, and most people don't even notice the differences, but the differences are there. Christ totally changed and totally expanded the understanding of the law and made it impossible to be followed. And Christ expanded the sum total of revelation, and so did the apostles in their writings, and so did Paul, who through the mystery received the final revelation.
Yeah.
So, you know, revelation is progressive. That would be an interesting study for us to go through.
Yeah, it would, because there are people out there, David, that say, you know, there's no more revelation. Everything's been fulfilled. And, you know,
yeah.
I mean, that's like whatever that is, praetorism or whatever they call it. It's
Preterism.
Like a doctrine from hell, you know.
And there's people who believe, you know, if it's,
yeah.
the King James is good enough for Jesus and the apostles, it's good enough for me.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
well Jesus,
what are you going to do?
Didn't have the King James.
No.
You know, and neither did the apostles.
No.
You know, and
they didn't speak English, folks.
Right. And in their day, in the day of King James, the King James Bible, you could call it a political publication.
Right. Right.
You know. And the people at that time were running around, I'll be damned if I'll give up my Geneva Bible. This King James Bible is from hell. You know, I mean, I can just hear people saying that.
Absolutely. And
you
it
know,
was that way for about 100 years.
Yeah, until they got people weaned off the
mm-hmm.
Geneva Bible. Yeah. Oh, gee. It's really amusing. Gee. People. Anyway, I'm hoping I can talk you into doing a file with me on time.
Sure.
Time events. Because that there's just, I'm very attracted to that. And
we'll make time to talk about time.
Yeah, I think we will be experiencing some strange phenomena concerning time.
Mm-hmm.
So now, are we is our
this is ended this?
Okay, so
yeah.
Okay, so this is the last audio file in the series "Idolatry and God's Punishment," and it's number 4. If you have questions or comments, please contact David Seeloff at this address, david@askelm.com. Go to the website, askelm.com, and take a look around. The link to the article that these audio files in this 4-part series are based on is right there together with the audio files. It says, read the article. And if you look around the Ask Elm website, you will find more information on this topic. This is George Ann Hughes with David Seeloff, the Director of Associates for Scriptural Knowledge, signing off. And we'll be back, God willing. God bless you, David, for the work you're doing, your time and your effort. And God bless everyone out there listening. Good night, everybody.